My name is Bubba, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, everybody.
I want to say a couple of words. I'm not going to make a talk because we got a speaker here to do that. But, you know, this is a time of year to be grateful and to be thankful for what we've had. And tonight I am very, very thankful for a lot of things. I have been, this is my 22nd sober Christmas. And I have always been grateful for the fact that I have been allowed to be sober that long. But tonight is a little bit different in a way. I'm very thankful that I'm here and sober. And I just wanted you to know that's the way I feel tonight. because I am very grateful. Tonight we have a very special person in my life for our speaker. She makes a good talk, and I like to listen to her, and I'll give you Janet.
My name is Janet Johnson, and I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic. And that may be all I get out. I want you to know I've been dreading this for 3 years. When I was in the hospital, we would come over here and I'd say, there's no way I could get up there and do that. And I really have. To me, somehow or another, Scotland came to represent the epitome of a large group with a lot of people that I had a lot of respect for. And so it is with a lot of gratitude that I'm here tonight. I really appreciate being a part of this birthday. Beverly and Annette and I were all in the hospital together. I'm not sure if they were in the hospital together, but I was in the hospital with both of them, which tells you something about the length of my stay while I was there. But I am glad to share tonight, but it has never been easy for me to share. Maybe someday it will be, but it is very difficult. But one of the things I think that sort of saved my life was the fact that for the first time in my life when I was in the hospital, I did come to the decision to do whatever they told me to do, and I had never made that decision before, and I had tried to do that. And one of the things they told me was that in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, to try to say yes when you are asked to do something. And so I'm trying to do that tonight and to say to these birthday people, thank you, and to Beverly, how much I love you, and to this special lady over here, how much I love you. Well, let's see. How was it? Well, my story doesn't start off much different from a lot of the others you hear about. I'm the product of a Southern Baptist home and all the things that that means. I think perhaps the first thing that happened in my life maybe that had a little bit to do with addiction is the fact that I think my first addiction was to my father. The home I was raised in was one where the discipline was very strict, and it seemed to work for most people, but it had a different effect on me and sort of broke my spirit, so that when I was about two and a half, I quit talking. And then they knew something was the matter. And first they thought I was a mental defective. And I think they took me somewhere for testing and decided it wasn't quite that bad. But something evidently was wrong, because in the process of sort of being broken down with the discipline in the home, I had lost contact with reality, actually, was what had happened to me. And there wasn't any money for psychiatric help at that time, but my father did have a psychologist friend and evidently told him that the only way to get me back in touch with reality would be to invest a lot of time with me. And so that's what my father did. He was a school teacher, and he spent hours with me, talking and carrying me everywhere he went. And he was a math was one of his fields, and so we would spend Sunday afternoons working math problems. But in the process of building that sort of relationship with me, I think I became addicted to him, and that sort of set the stage for a lifestyle. And I think my addiction goes throughout my life. I think it has to do with the way I relate to people. It has to do with the way I approach life. It has to do with the way I look at things. But this is the first time, too, that I have to say that I'm grateful that I'm an addict, because I think that addiction saved my life and gave me a possibility even for normal development. And I'm grateful, of course, today for my addiction, because it's given me a possibility of a way of life that I have not ever known before. I had an older sister and a brother that was a little bit younger, and then 18 years later I had another sister. But I didn't like them. Never was close to any of my siblings. There was a lot of sibling rivalry, and since Daddy spent so much time with me, I was the pet in their eyes. And so we never were very close as brothers and sisters. And sometimes I don't like them now. But we do get along better now that I'm sober. And I have come to realize that, of course, a lot of the problems in terms of my relationship with them had to do with my addiction in the last few years. I wasn't a particularly outstanding student in high school. I did okay. It was about then, I got to back up and tell you where my ambition came from. I was the product of a depression. And I remember one day, when I was about 7, I was standing across the creek from my father and my grandfather. And we were hungry, and there weren't enough clothes, and sometimes we were not very warm in the wintertime. Daddy had a 6-year degree, and my grandfather had graduated from Clemson. And I knew that, and I remember looking at those two men and thinking, you know, if you can't take care of me, I'll do it myself. And I determined to get something in my head, inside of my mind, so that my children would not ever know the want that I knew, so that they would not ever be hungry. And how a child would know to head toward medicine from that point, I don't know. But from that moment on, I was going to be a doctor. And I became addicted to that idea. And my whole life, from then until I graduated from medical school, was focused around that. And I realized that that's sort of an addiction, too. And I was one-minded in the way that I pursued it, and I pursued my career the same way that I later pursued my addiction. Another thing that learning about addiction since I realized that I am an alcoholic has taught me, too, that I heard it said, I guess it was in an AA meeting the first time, that if you want an alcoholic to do something, tell them they can't do it. And so I owe that part of my personality to part of my success in terms of reaching one of my big goals in life, because all through high school and all through college, all my classmates and many of the teachers said, you can't do it. You know, you're not going to make it to med school. You won't even graduate from college. And I can remember every time they said that, I said, I'll show you. And here again, I think that said something to do about the addictiveness in my personality. It didn't say anything to me, though, about not taking drugs. I didn't hear that part of it. But I was very ambitious. I determined to get what I wanted, no matter what it cost me or anybody else. And very competitive. I went to North Georgia College, and anything they had to win up there, I won it. I was valedictorian in my class, most likely to succeed, most intellectual, Miss NGC, sweetheart of the battalion. It didn't make any difference. If there was something to win, I made up my mind that I would do it, and it was a tremendous success at it. I saw to it that I was the teacher's pet. I worked for the head of the department and the man that was going to give me a recommendation to med school. And I stacked all the cards in my favor, and I was pretty successful at it. One of the things that I'm not very proud of, but it's a part of my story, is that if people got in my way of what I wanted to do, I would get them out no matter what I had to do. If I had to step on them, I stepped on them. If I had to kick them out of the way, I did that too. And I don't like criticism very much. I've always been very sensitive to being criticized, and none of you were like that, I'm sure. But I remember one day in college that the teacher was out of the room, and two of the students made fun of me and criticized me for being the teacher's pet. And I could not stand to be belittled. You know, it just does something to me when somebody makes fun of me. And I remember saying to myself, you know, just wait. I'll get you. And none of you said that either, have you? But they didn't know I was grading their papers. And sure enough, I did get them. Neither one of them made it to med school. But it was easy for me to get in because, you know, with that sort of ambition and stacking the cards in my favor, it really wasn't any problem. And I did go to the Medical College of Georgia. I had trouble borrowing money, though, to get in. They didn't loan women money to go to medical school back then. And I got a scholarship that was going to pay for tuition and for books. But how was I going to pay for room and board? Where was I going to get my food, and how was I going to pay my rent? Well, this man came along who was a senior in medical school, and he was going through school on the GI Bill, and so I fell in love with him and married him. And it was only after I got into this program that I got honest enough to look back and see that even though I sincerely thought I loved that man, that really I'm afraid part of what I was doing was here again just realizing my ambition. I had thankfully, though, been raised in a home that taught real strict duties in terms of who a wife is and what a mother is. And with that sort of ambition, I'm really grateful that that's a part of my background because I really did put a lot into my marriage, but I'll have to say that that was my first institutional failure. Married just before I went to medical school, and I loved medical school. It was hard work, but I loved everything I was studying, and it was just fascinating. Everything I studied just seemed like fun to me, and it was a good part of my life, a good time in my life. It wasn't a very good way to build a marriage, though, with two people studying that much and working that hard. We really didn't get to know each other, and I sometimes wondered that perhaps the marriage would have been a little bit better had we had a little more leisure in those early months of marriage. After medical school, I had an internship and then did a residency in pediatrics, and I really, really loved my work. We moved to Gainesville, Georgia, and I went into practice in pediatrics and was very successful. In about 3 years, I really had all the practice I could handle, and because by that time I had three children, I sort of cut back on my practice a little bit. I was a very conscientious mother, and I guess if I were to say what I thought was the most successful part of my life, I would have to say that I really am a fantastic mother. I've got three beautiful children, and I'm so proud of them. I am so grateful, too, for the fact that I did not get into my addiction until after my children were out of their early formative years. I am very grateful for that. Alcohol was not a part of my life up until this time. I was raised in a teetotaling Baptist home and married the son of a Baptist minister. And he was completely intolerant toward alcohol in any form. And so there was no drinking in my life until, I guess, after I'd been in practice 4 or 5 years. And I really didn't start with alcohol. I might drink a little bit, but I really got started on drugs in 1965. I had a child in my practice that was acutely allergic to bee stings and had been in shock a couple of times. And they were an outdoors family, and they wanted to go camping. And I was teaching this mother how to give shots so that if the child had an allergic reaction, she could give him some adrenaline and have time to get him to a hospital. And I let the mother practice on me, and I was trying to let her give me whatever shots I hadn't had in a while. And so she gave me a TB skin test one day, and it turned out to be positive, and so I found out that I had pulmonary tuberculosis and had to leave practice for a while. And here again, I'm very grateful for who I am. I don't think anybody but an addict would have had a mother practicing on them to teach him how to give them shots. But that saved me a lot of problems because I found that I had tuberculosis before it became contagious. And so I'm very grateful, again, for the fact that I have the characteristics that most of us here have. But in any event, they told me in order to get well from the tuberculosis that I would have to sleep 8 hours a night. Well, I hadn't ever slept 8 hours a night. And so they put me on a sedative, and that was my introduction to drugs. I don't think I became addicted at that time, but I'm sure it was working in that direction. The next thing that sort of put the cap on the jaw as far as addiction is concerned was somewhere around 1970, and I'm not sure about the date in the last 10 years because I sort of specialized in blackout. And I've had a real hard time putting the dates back together. I sat down, I guess the second inventory I took, and tried to piece the dates down and get it straight in my mind, and all I did was really get confused. And so some of these dates are maybe not absolutely accurate. But somewhere around 1970, I began to have some sort of visual problem and some crazy physical symptoms. And in relating these to physicians, one in particular, they decided that I had a type of epilepsy that had to do with the intake of light. And so I went through a couple of neurology clinics in big medical centers. And the diagnosis of epilepsy was made, and I was told that in order to drive and in order to practice, I would have to take medication. And so I was put on phenobarbital, and within 18 months, I was addicted. During that 18 months, I did not abuse the drug. I took it as it was prescribed. But after 18 months, I realized that my body had lost its tolerance. But see, I called it that. I didn't call it addiction. However, my story is the same as I think every other addict is. Once I crossed that line over into addiction, then I became completely indiscriminate in the way that I use drugs. I see myself as a total addict. And I think toward the end of my addiction, I was playing Russian roulette with my head, and I pretty well messed it up. I would try anything in terms of a drug. I never did use street drugs because I never really had to. I'm sort of like the doctor that said his other friends opened their mail and he ate his. And this is the way it was, you know. There was no point in me writing prescriptions for drugs. I really didn't need to. The drug companies would give you whatever you wanted. And so my drug habit never cost me anything in terms of money. I started getting in and adding booze to my drugs when we were doing some travel in Europe because I was very much afraid that my drugs wouldn't last until I got home. And so I started adding wine to my drugs to be sure I didn't give out. And I liked it. And it seemed to work really better than some of my other drugs, and it became one of my favorite drugs. It took me a while, though, to remember too much about the alcohol part of my addiction. One of the funny things I realized after I got sober was that my drinking partner was my maid. And she drove me all over Georgia, and we had a great time together. But she was a diabetic, and I was so afraid, because she was a diabetic, that she was going to become an alcoholic. And so we would go in the liquor store, and I wouldn't let her buy but a half a pint, but I bought a half a gallon. And I remember when I got out of the hospital, she was really disappointed to find out that there weren't going to be any more salty dogs. And she never did quite understand that, and I'm not sure she understands it today. I did think she called on to the program one day, though, when she said, you know, I can't go to any of those meetings with you. But the other night I was in my room and I heard this voice saying, Marion, don't drink no more of that rum. So I decided with that meeting somehow she'd had a spiritual experience. And I think she is sober today. But she was a beautiful person and a real meaningful part of my life. And I think she probably saved my life several times because she was doing the driving most of the time. Let's see. I don't know how I got off of that tale. My first child when I graduated from medical school, I was pregnant with my first child. I was really going to manage my life. I was going to have my children exactly when I want them, and I was going to be the best mother in the world and the best wife in the world and the best doctor in the world all at the same time, and obviously that was an impossible ambition for me. But I had a daughter, and then 3 years later, son, and 18 months later, another son, and they are 25, 22, and 21 now. My daughter is a freshman in medical school, and the middle son's at Georgia. He's an art major, and my baby is in pre-med at North Georgia. And they really are beautiful people. I think my addiction has given them a strength too, and I, of course, have a lot of guilt and a lot of sadness over the embarrassment that I caused them and the fact that I specialized in falling, too, when I was drunk. And soon they didn't bring any of their friends home anymore, but I do remember falling a lot, and they would have to come and try to get Mother back in bed, and I remember them telling me later about how embarrassing it was for them to be having a party in the basement, and they would hear this loud noise, and they would know that, well, Mother's fallen again. And they would have to somehow excuse themselves and come upstairs and try to get me in bed. Toward the end of my addiction, I simply stayed in my bedroom. I worked, though, almost all the time up until the time I came into the hospital, but somehow or another I could manage to get sober enough to work. Another thing I'm the most grateful for is the fact that I don't have any evidence that I hurt a child when I was practicing my addiction. And I've had the same experience many of you have had. That is, when I went back to practice, I had to look at some of the handwriting I'd done when I was practicing my addiction. And I haven't found any evidence that I hurt a child, but I do know that it's only because God was protecting those children and because some things happened in my life to get me out of practice before I really did something that was disastrous. And I'm really grateful for that today. Another part of my life I want to share with briefly is that somewhere along in there I gave my practice up to stay at home with the children for about 5 years. I did that, and I'm glad that I did. But during that time, when I began to get bored, I served as medical director of a skilled care nursing facility. And I had never really enjoyed working with old people. And I didn't think I would be good at it because my training and my experience was in pediatrics. But I was really good with those elderly people that were facing death. I found that I really could help the people to die, and I really had a knack for helping the families to know how to help those people to die. And after I got in this program and was looking back over my life, I realized that I was able to help those people die because I was dying myself. They knew on an intuitive level that I was experiencing some of the same feelings that they were. And I'm glad today that I hope that in what I'm doing now that I'm giving life and that I don't have to help any more people to understand death. And that was one of the things that's been a real shock to me in my inventory since I've been in the program. You know, how did I get into treatment? Not only had my life become unmanageable, but so had I. And sometimes I tell the patients about the fact that we are so deaf when we are practicing our addiction, and I could not hear anything anybody said to me. Nobody could tell me anything, and my family tried to tell me that I was in trouble. My children tried to tell me I was in trouble. My husband tried to tell me I was in trouble. I can remember in the mornings that they would beg me not to drive to work. But I never listened to anybody. The thing that got my attention was one morning on the way to work, and at that time I was living in Gainesville and practicing in Dahlonega, which was about a 20-mile drive. And I went off the side of the mountain at 7 o'clock one morning and totaled my husband's favorite car and got a concussion and also got a DUI. And I've looked at a lot of drug screens in the last 2 years, but I've never looked at a drug screen that had as many different drugs in it as my drug screen did that morning that I got that DUI. But that really didn't bother me at the time. It never dawned on me that I wouldn't get by with that. After all, you know, I had epilepsy. I had to take all those drugs. And it didn't dawn on me that perhaps this was going to be a turning point in my life. The judge was one of my good friends. He and I had worked together on the mental health board, and we'd started a child guidance clinic, and I thought I had it made, but it turned out that this man cared more about me than I thought. He wouldn't let me do anything with that ticket. Neither would he hear me in his chambers. He made me go before him in Superior Court in Hall County, and that was a very embarrassing experience for me. And he threw the book at me in public that way, and somehow or another, that did get my attention, and I didn't come into treatment immediately, but it did start me to thinking about the fact that I better seriously consider doing something about my drug habit. The other thing I think that finally got me into treatment was that my mother confronted me with my addiction. And she and I had been close for a good while, not when I was a child, but as an adult, we had become close. And a lot of her financial support came from me. And I guess I thought maybe I manipulated her, and perhaps I was doing that. But in any event, when she confronted me about my addiction, I realized that she was taking a real risk in terms of what it would mean to her life if I withdrew my support. And the risk that she was willing to take somehow got through to me and said to me how much she cared for me and that maybe I should listen. So I decided that maybe I was taking a few too many drugs and that I would come off. But just like most doctors, I didn't know very much about addiction. But I did come off of drugs at home. And by that time, though, I had lost all of my self-esteem. I despised myself, had no self-respect left whatsoever, had no desire to live. And I guess I was afraid I was not going to die and that maybe I was going to have to live that miserable for a long time. About the time I realized, I got to drop back and tell you, I had a little psychiatric help in there. When I got into trouble with my marriage, I started going to a psychiatrist, a very beautiful man here in Atlanta. A lot of times at AA meetings, I hear people criticize the fact that psychiatrists don't help alcoholics very much. But this psychiatrist helped this one. And it says in How It Works that there are those two who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. And that's what I think this psychiatrist did for me. He enabled me to get honest enough with myself so that I could make this program. And I'm very grateful for that. And there are some of us who need not only AA, but who need some counseling help on the side. And that's okay. And it's okay with me to say that for myself. And it's okay if I need some help in the future. But when I got into my addiction heavy, I stopped going to him because I knew he would know what was going on. But after I realized I was in trouble and decided maybe I'd do something about it, I did go back to him and tell him what was going on. But I told him I was going to come off the drugs at home. And so he and I talked about the possibilities for hospitalization if I had to go. And I told him that, well, if I had to go in the hospital, if I didn't make it on my own, that just find me a hospital somewhere where the head doctor was an alcoholic and a drug addict, that I wasn't interested in going to anybody who couldn't relate to me in terms of where I was coming from. But here again, I was very sensitive to criticism and to being belittled or looked down on. And so we decided that if I needed to go in, that we would go into Peachford because he knew Dr. Hunter and his sort of his life story. I did come off the drugs at home, and I guess it was pretty rough. I had the DTs and the bloody diarrhea and the vomiting and hallucinations and the seizures, but it was bad. But I knew what was going on. And I didn't much want to live anyway. So that was okay. The thing that I didn't understand about addiction was that it wasn't going to be over when the drugs got out, because after about 10 days, I found myself in fear and terror like I had never known before. I was acquainted with fear, as most of us are, and had lived with fear at different times in my life, but not ever the sort of terror that I found myself in after about 10 days of coming off of drugs. And it was this terror that got me into the hospital. That was what I could not handle on my own, and so I really asked for protective custody and went into Peachford Hospital in November of 1977. And many of the people here tonight who were very influential in my recovery there in the hospital. Every morning, Natalie would hang back after rounds and say to me, "Has anybody told you that they loved you today?" And so she would tell me that and tell me that she loved me. And Sarah was there, and Ellie was there, and Bubba was there, and John was there. John was mainly getting up lists, telling us where to go at night and stuff like that. But the staff there really did care for me, and it was important, too, I think, for me to share with you the importance of the patient community in my recovery. I didn't realize, of course, that I was sicker than most of the other patients, but because I evidently looked sicker to them, and there's Shirley, she was there. and there's Don, he was there, too. You know, they seemed to think I needed their help, too. That maybe the staff wasn't going to be enough, and so the patient sort of adopted me as the person to look after. And I remember that I didn't have a watch for the first 6 weeks, and I didn't really need one, because whenever there was time to do something, you know, it was, "Janet, come on, let's go to lunch," or, "Janet, it's time to go to class," or, "Janet, it's time for group." And so for the first time in my life, I let people look after me. You know, I was the person that looked after people. And so addiction got me to my knees. You know, it brought me completely to my knees, and I arrived at the hospital completely helpless and completely hopeless. And for me, I think that was the only way, because if I'd been any less on the bottom, I don't think I would have been able to become a patient. I was so accustomed to being a physician. And I think the fact that addiction whipped me so thoroughly was the thing that enabled me to say to the staff and to the other people and to the patients, you know, "I need you." And it was the thing that enabled me to say to the people in AA that "I need you, and I need you today just as much as I have ever needed you." I didn't like AA meetings in the hospital. I thought they were horrible. These people were laughing and hugging each other and kissing each other, and I thought it was all a fraud. The drugs were such a big part of me, and my confusion was such that I could not even get the message of the sincerity of the love and the caring that we know in the AA program. And of course, now I am grateful that I can feel your love and that I can know your care, and that I can be very much aware of how much love and care you do give. I think most of my life I had sought out a support system that would be adequate for me, and I had never found it. But I have found the AA program, and I'm in the NA program, too. I have found that it was adequate for me. I was sick in the hospital, and it was really rough for me when I got out of the hospital. The first 3 months, I guess, it was really touch and go, and I came to understand very quickly what they meant when they said you would have to cut your day down maybe to making it for 10 minutes. And there was no practice there when I got back to pick up my practice, and I had to start building it over. But that was a blessing for me, because I couldn't have handled very much. And I would have to see one patient and then go to the bathroom and say the serenity prayer and try to get it back together and then go see another patient. And I literally existed in those first few months from one AA meeting to the next. I would go to an AA meeting and somehow get enough strength and enough hope and enough courage to make it through another 24 hours. And so I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that if you will work the AA program, it will work for you. If you really want to get well, no matter how sick you are, what you need in order to get well is available for you at AA meetings and through the AA people. The thing I first learned about people in AA was how trustworthy they were. I'd never been in a group of people where I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that they were interested in my well-being, and therefore they were trustworthy, that I could trust them to want what was best for me, and that they would be there whenever I needed them. I remember when I went back to Gainesville after leaving the hospital and being to meetings down here, I wondered how it was going to be. Well, the meetings up there were different. In fact, they're a little bit tougher in a way. I remember the first night I walked into an AA meeting, or I opened that door, and that was the roughest looking bunch of men I'd ever seen in my life. And there weren't any women in there. But that was okay. You know, I've been in that situation before. But I walked in and nobody asked me if I belonged in Al-Anon. Nobody suggested maybe I was in the wrong room. They seemed to be able to tell that I was in the right place. And they were really good for me. And they told me later that my coming into the program increased that attendance because they all wanted to come back and see if I made it another day. But, you know, when I look back over that, I'm so grateful. And I believe in prevenience and that, you know, the Lord goes before to prepare the way. Because I think He put the sort of groups available to me in my recovery, the sort of people that I needed to help me grow. Got in one group over in Athens, and there wasn't but one meeting in Gainesville at that time, and so I got to sort of travel all over Georgia. And one of the fears that I was dealing with was the fear of driving alone and driving at night. And the first year I was in this program, I got over that fear because there was no way for me to get to meetings but to get out and drive. And I would practice, you know, I'd go hunt for the meeting in the daytime before I'd have to go at night. But they used to say, too, to let the program work. And I would say to them back, you can let the program work, but I have to work this program. And I really did. And I worked the program the same way that I sought my ambitions out, and it's paid off for me. My practice did rebuild itself. I did try to follow directions. I didn't make any major decisions for the first year. I love pediatrics. I got back into pediatrics. But by that time and through my AA experience, my heart was in addiction. And so I started working as a volunteer over at Peachtree when we had the youth unit, and I loved it. And then when we didn't have the youth unit, I started working with the whole group and started 2 days a week last spring and have been there full time since September. And I really love what I do. I feel sure that I'll never be bored with my work again. I feel sure that every day that I'm at Peachtree, it's going to be a challenge. And I know that if it gets bored, that some of the patients are going to see that it livens up for me that day. But I really love what I'm doing, and I enjoy the challenge, and I think addicts and alcoholics are the most wonderful people in the world. I have more joy in my life today than I have ever had before. And I have had periods in my life before I got into my addiction in which I was happy with my life and I was happy with myself. But there's an element of joy in my life now that I have not ever known before. I like myself again. I love what I'm doing. I like who I am. I like how I feel when I get up in the mornings, and I've never liked mornings. You know, I've not hungover. I do have to spend a lot of time early in the morning in meditation and prayer. I think for me, part of my addiction is the fact that when I wake up early in the morning, a lot of times negative thoughts and negative feelings come boiling out of my brain, and I guess I've stuffed them down there for a few years. But one of the, you know, real meaningful parts of this program is that early morning meditation and prayer time in which I turn my negative thoughts to positive ones. And I have some devotional books that I read, including the Day by Day and the 24-hour book. And so I spend some time in the morning establishing my conscious contact with God, and I have to have that. I need Him in my life in the same way that I need you in my life. And I want to say to each of you how grateful I am that you are a part of my life. how much I thank you that you care for me and that you have been willing to love me, and how glad I am that I know that when I need you tomorrow, you're going to be there, and that wherever I am and however it is for me, I have a group of people who are with me, who understand me, and who love me, and will do whatever they need to do to give me the sort of support and the caring that I need in my life. And John Keats said something that I want to close with, and that was this: I love you the more in that I think you have liked me for my own self and for nothing else. Thank you.
Thank all of you for letting me be the chairman tonight. Parents, will you lead us in the Lord's Prayer, please?